Well, we're back, and wanted to talk a little bit about the Eisenhower era. You know, remember, President Truman had been had taken over for Franklin Roosevelt on April 12, 1945. He was very plain spoken, but he made some very gutsy decisions, like ordering the dropping of the atomic bomb, or firing Douglas MacArthur during the Korean War in April of 1951. And then, of course, signing things like the Taft-Hartley Act, which began the open shop, or desegregating the military and federal jobs, winning the 1948 election on his own. And then, of course, completing his term in 1952. The 1952 election was a really interesting election because Dwight David Eisenhower was so loved by both parties that both parties literally wanted him to run as their standard bearer, as their candidate. And but he decided to run on the Republican ticket. And Richard Nixon will be his vice president, already vice presidential candidate. Already by 1952, there was this feeling that Richard Nixon could be a bit of a shady character. There was the accusation that he was taking campaign gifts and not reporting them. And so Nixon will go on television and talk about how his wife, Pat, has a good Republican coat, that they're not very wealthy people. You know, basically he's trying to look like a common man. And in this checker speech, he talks about a Cocker Spaniel dog that a supporter had sent his two daughters. And it was a Cocker Spaniel, white and checkered, white and spotted. And that speech came to be called the checker speech. And it was the speech that saved Richard Nixon's candidacy in the 1952 election. One of the things that Eisenhower promised to do was to go to Korea personally if it meant ending the Korean War. The Korean War had been a limited war. It had been a very tough war. And by 1953, the Korean War would end precisely where it began in the summer of 1950 along the 38th parallel. Nixon and Eisenhower try to pursue some kind of middle way between laissez-faire economics and the New Deal. The 1950s is the great age of consumerism. It's the great age of Elvis. Elvis is one of the first entertainers to be mass marketed. It'll also be a really, really tough time in the Cold War. But it'll also be a good time for consumerism at home, because the spending after World War II is still going on. The Korean War had destroyed Truman's popularity, and like I said, Eisenhower promised to go to Korea personally if it meant ending the Korean War. And the war ends in a ceasefire in 1953 along the 38th parallel. You know, there's a great TV show called MASH, and of course it's set during the Korean War, but really it was made during the Vietnam era. To kind of talk a little bit about the Vietnam era, but again, there's this great series steeped in the Korean War. You know, Joseph McCarthy, senator from Wisconsin, had, you know, helped between 1947 and 1954 this Red Scare, this time in American history when spies were very relevant. During the Truman era, you had the Rosenbergs being arrested and tried and executed for spying, for espionage. Joseph McCarthy would head up a time when communists are investigated in government agencies, chiefly the State Department. Eisenhower never really challenged his claims, and even though you had the Rosenbergs, you had the Alger Hiss case, where supposedly secrets were stored in a hollowed-out pumpkin. And as the arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States really starts to heat up, by the early 1950s, the Soviets have developed the hydrogen bomb. Of course, our hydrogen bomb will be tested about 1952, and then the Soviet Union will test their hydrogen bomb by 1953. It's a tough time in the Cold War, and Joseph McCarthy will insinuate that there are spies in the State Department, and there were. Were there to the degree that he was saying no? About 1954, Joseph McCarthy is accusing the Army of being communist. So some very famous hearings, the Army McCarthy hearings, will take place. But basically, that's the end of McCarthyism. You know, Joseph McCarthy had some very famous names working in his government offices, and of course you had Roy Cohn, and you had a very young lawyer by the name of Robert Kennedy working to fight communists in government during the early 1950s. One of the people that Eisenhower had going for him was the Secretary of Defense, okay? Secretary of State, and that was John Foster Dulles. John Foster Dulles came up with some ideas to, again, work on continuing to contain communism. And one idea was massive retaliation, letting the enemy know if they hit you that you are going to retaliate massively. Another one was, you know, brinkmanship, being willing to go to the brink of war if it meant stopping a larger or greater war from happening. So brinkmanship and massive retaliation were things that John Foster Dulles, as Secretary of State, kind of adhered to. And one of the things that's happening in the 1950s is the beginning of the arms race and also the acceleration of the space race. The Eisenhower Doctrine. If the Truman Doctrine was about containing communism, the Eisenhower Doctrine stated again that the U.S. should try to defend any nation against communism. In 1953, Joseph Stalin dies, and the new Soviet leader is Nikita Khrushchev. In 1954, the Soviets will suppress an attempt by native Hungarians to have a revolt against their Soviet controllers, and of course it was not successful. Eisenhower pledged support to Hungary, but Hungary was a landlocked country. There was really no way to get that support in there. At home during the 1950s, with the evolution of the television being affordable to most Americans then, with rock and roll, with the word teenager starting to become an everyday thing, you also have duck and cover drills. And these were drills that all citizens did in a way to prepare for some kind of nuclear attack. In 1957, the USSR developed the intercontinental ballistic missile, and of course this was a new thing that made Americans nervous about a quicker nuclear attack, the possibility of a quicker nuclear attack by the Soviet Union. And also in 1957, the Soviets launched Sputnik, the first man-made satellite, and this really scared Americans, because, you know, as I will tell you in class, in a race, you're either ahead or behind. And with Sputnik being launched later, with Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin going into space in 1959, there was a feeling that the Soviets will be ahead of us. The launch of Sputnik will help to bring about the creation of NASA, the National Aeronautical Space Administration. And in 1958, the United States will launch its first satellite. The United States had a better heat shield. The Soviets had a better rocket. And, you know, this will be a great age of spying on heat shields and rockets. In 1959, an unmarked supposed weather plane piloted by Francis Gary Powers is shot down over the Soviet Union. Well, it was no weather plane. It was a high-altitude U-2 spy plane. But this U-2 incident, as it was called, kind of cools over the planned Eisenhower-Khrushchev summit meeting. And as we'll see, leaders from here on out will get together to meet, to have summits, to talk about things. And basically, if you've seen the movie Bridge of Spies, you understand how Francis Gary Powers gets home, because eventually the United States and the Soviet Union and the East Germans will trade spies. And that's how Francis Gary Powers gets home. Later on, he is killed in the 1970s. But this was a very important event, the shooting down of a high-altitude U-2 spy plane. You know, as we talked about presidents who have the possibility of two terms, usually end up having a better first term. In Eisenhower's second term, you have the rising of civil rights issues. You have Eisenhower having a heart attack. And Eisenhower, who had basically taken on a grandfatherly role by this time, will be thinking about things like attacking Cuba. In 1959, the Batista government, the largely friendly government in Cuba, will be overturned by Fidel Castro. And so already American CIA people are trying to determine how best to fight Castro and his regime. At home, like I said, you have TVs, you have rock and roll, you have things like American Bandstand, you have credit cards, you have suburbs with the Federal Highway Act of 1955. You have the beginning of civil rights. Eisenhower, unlike Truman, who had desegregated federal jobs and armed forces by executive order, in 1947, Eisenhower had largely been quiet on civil rights, but by the late 1950s, Eisenhower is going to have to step in at places like Little Rock and order federal troops to protect the students who are trying to integrate Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. The 1950s was also just a great age of advertising. It will also be a decade where the United States presides over the Suez incidents, and this is where Egypt was trying to nationalize the Suez Canal, and the British and the Israelis will go up against Israel, and the United States will help to mediate the Suez crisis. Billy Joel mentions this in his song "We Didn't Start the Fire." He says, "Trouble in the Suez." Also, by 1954, the United States will witness the collapse of the French fortress in Vietnam called Dien Bien Phu. And the United States will help to negotiate elections to be held in Vietnam 2 years later, by 1956. Those elections will never be held for fear that the country will go communist. And so, you know, Eisenhower's philosophy in relationship to Southeast Asia is that it will be the domino theory. If one country falls to communism in Southeast Asia, the rest will fall to communism. So the United States will block those elections, and they will begin to support the country of South Vietnam against Ho Chi Minh and North Vietnam. And so remember the domino theory, because that's something that's going to come into play. If we can talk just a couple minutes about 50s culture. We talked about the car culture with the suburbs and the interstate highway system. The interstate highway system was chiefly designed for military purposes. But also, this is a great way to connect the United States in this 1950s car culture. Even in our own area, if you're heading back from Conover to Lenore, you will see a blue sign on the side of the road. It's got five white stars on it, and it says Eisenhower Interstate. Things like McDonald's, Holiday Inn, you know, these are things that eventually will creep up as a result of the interstate highway system. And also, you have the rise of suburbia, where people can choose the luxury of working in town and living in a suburb. Conversely, this creates something called white flight in the inner cities. And basically, people with the means can move out to a suburb, and that leaves people of poverty, people of oftentimes Hispanic or black origin who don't have the middle class ability to move out into the suburbs, they're left in the cities. And so later on in the 1960s, in places like Detroit and Newark, there'll be urban riots based on this white flight and the lack of economic opportunity. In the 1950s and 60s, you have a medical breakthrough with Jonas Salk and the polio vaccine. This was very important because the baby boom begins in 1946 and lasts till 1964, and it adds 24 or 25 million new children to the workforce. You know, television in the 1950s was just a blank canvas to do all kinds of things. The best show in America was I Love Lucy. And most of your television was live. And while most sociologists say that the microwave is really going to change America's eating habits, the television also is involved there. You begin to have, you know, refrigeration, more refrigeration. You begin to have more frozen dinners, TV trays. And just like Americans schedule their time by radio in the 1920s and 30s, Americans will begin to schedule their time around television. You know, there's a problem with television, and that is that it was quite stereotypical. If you look at shows like Leave It to Beaver or Ozzie and Harriet, there was the nice, comfortable home. You know, a few kids, a husband and a wife. The husband worked, the wife stayed home. You know, if you look at Barbara Billingsley as Beaver Cleaver's mom, she's always wearing a dress. You know, what television does is it enforces some stereotypes about men and women and families in the 1950s and 60s. Women appeared often as homemakers. Males were, you know, dads, and they were working and coming home. So, you know, it's just something to think about. The 1950s was this great age of science fiction. And so you have all kind of science fiction movies. You have 3D movies. You begin to have color on television. Movies like The Blob will, you know, show 1950s culture. You know, a great question about the 1950s is, was it a time of conformity? You know, cookie cutter houses, families using the Serviceman's Readjustment Act or the GI Bill to buy a ranch home, a cookie cutter home in a suburb, and GIs could buy a new home for less than $8,000. But, you know, rock and roll, you know, was it a time of conformity? You know, and some of the things I've told you would certainly augment that. But then there was another side of life called the Beatniks, the Beat Movement. You had Allen Ginsberg writing poems like Howl. You had novels like On the Road being written by Jack Kerouac. You had the Beat Generation coming out of Greenwich Village, New York. And these were folks who basically went against the grain. You know, talked against some conformity, talked against the suburbia. And, you know, the Beatniks will set the pace for the hippie generation of the 1960s. And basically these were folks who just clashed with the mainstream. One of the best stories my dad tells about the 1950s was he was in typing class in high school or in middle school, and he remembered a gentleman not very successful in typing just unplugging his typewriter and throwing it out the window. That's a good example of a beatnik, somebody kind of going against the grain. Again, rock and roll, all right, really set the pace for the 1950s. You began to have dance-a-thons. You began to have Motown. You begin to have you know, different vibrations, and a lot of these songs will sing about cruising in your automobile. A lot of these songs will end up also being about civil rights. You'll have Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Bill Haley, Buddy Holly, Elvis Presley, and they're going on several shows. They're going on the Steve Allen Show, or they're going on the Ed Sullivan Show. Dick Clark will start American Bandstand. And so television and teenagers and different kinds of dress moves into the mainstream. One of the things that begins to happen in the 1950s and 60s is people kind of reawaken themselves with poverty. And there was a book by Michael Harrington called The Other America. And it very quickly stressed that one out of every four Americans, or one-fourth of America as a whole, was living below the poverty line. This book, Michael Harrington's Other America, will really affect future presidents like John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. And so think about the things we've talked about: white flight, growth of the suburbs. You know, the loss of tax dollars hurts city services. And but when there is money, there'll be plans for urban renewal to take inner cities and change them up somehow. And, of course, that work still goes on. Many women in the 1950s reacted to this idea that women just had to be homemakers. They reacted to the stereotypes on television. And, you know, also many working women were paid less than men. So the new feminist movement is going to springboard off of some of these things from the 1950s. In 1962, Betty Friedan will write The Feminine Mystique. And Friedan's argument is that women don't just need to be considered homemakers, that they can have careers and they can maybe choose their own destiny a little bit more. Betty Friedan will be a founding member of NOW, the National Organization for Women. And this is the beginning of modern feminism, the modern women's liberation movement. As far as minority groups go, immigration from Mexico increased. Obviously, discrimination was faced by nearly all minorities in wages and pay. During World War II, there had been the Zoot Suit Riots of Latin American teenagers and Navy men in Los Angeles. There weren't a lot of rights for Latino Americans working in the country as part of a Bracero program. But there will be something called the Indian Reorganization Act during the 1940s and 50s that will give more power back to Native American tribes. Remember that the Dawes Act had basically detribalized Indians by giving them individual plots of land. Under the Indian Reorganization Act, power will be given back to the tribes. Like we said, in the 1950s, if presidents were fortunate enough to have two terms, they generally had a better first term. And like we said with Eisenhower, Vietnam, problems in the Middle East, and civil rights will kind of dominate Eisenhower's second term. And at the time of 1960, in a very close election between Richard Nixon and John Kennedy, John Kennedy will become the youngest elected president in the United States. Eisenhower was not comfortable as the oldest American president at the time, turning over the country to the youngest elected president. In fact, Eisenhower called Kennedy that boy, and there wasn't a lot of feeling that Kennedy is going to do a good job. But as we move into the next lecture, we'll see if that was the case.